Oh, it is time to start. I'm Joan Hunt, I'm campus pastor at Portland State University, and I'm not an expert on the Old Testament or on the life of King David before or after he became king. But I have looked up some things organized especially around some relationships that David had that are ones we might have heard about in Sunday school or earlier in our lives. The aim is to look at them now with from where we are now and see how the things that David was involved in illuminate our own choices, struggles, questions, challenges, reflections, and so on. So today we're looking at the celebrated friendship between David and Jonathan. I want to read a couple paragraphs about women's friendships and men's friendships in our own day from an article by Celia Allison Hahn, who is a researcher for the Alban Institute, which studies church life in America. Women friends. If you listen to women, you might think that they place less value on their relationships with women friends than on a romantic encounter. But if you watch them, you'll probably conclude that women's friendships are broader and deeper than men's, and fill a woman's needs for intimacy in ways that their relationships with men cannot do. The importance of equality in friendships seems to support friendships among women, both by choice and by virtue of their subordinate status. Women are less intensely involved in the many kinds of hierarchical rankings that separate their brothers into the up-down divisions that preclude friendly equal relationships. While human friendship seems to be about sharing both private worlds and public enterprises, women lean toward the self-disclosure end of that continuum, perhaps because we view creating the connection as a valuable end in itself. When provided with a reasonably safe structure, most women will happily share their quite personal truths about their own lives with someone they've never seen before and find their experience thereby enriched. Thus, Women's Corner on the human friendship market emphasizes close attention to the art of making friendship into a shape, a high value for equality, and a hunger for the exchange not only of words, but of their very being. Make sense so far? Do you generally agree so far? Men's friendships. While women's friendships are more important to them than they let on, men's friendships have a higher profile in the reporting than in actual experience. Though women have few words for friendship, men have many: pal, crony, buddy, mate, sidekick. This plurality of words notwithstanding, a chorus of observers reports that most men don't seem to have close friends. A lot of men don't know anybody very well except their wives. 2 summers ago, I listened to some Canadian clergymen talking about their loneliness. One of them said, "I have fishing buddies, yard work buddies, drinking buddies, colleagues on the job, and couples friends. But I need more than that. I need friendships where I can talk about my personal needs and struggles. I can't tell you what it means to me that I don't have to be careful with you guys." One man wrote in his end of class reflection, "I've become aware of my own deep longing for male friendship, which can be on my terms, and not the socially acceptable and expected level of buddies." Even when men do sidle up to their buddies, their behavior often seems conflicted, marked many times by sarcasm and backslapping, reminiscent of the wrestling with which boys express affection for one another. One notes how often a tentative hug is accompanied by vigorous back pounding, which demonstrates that nothing sensual is going on. The equality required by friendship seems to discourage as many male friendships as it encourages female ones. One man said of his 3 friends, "There are some things I wouldn't tell them. For example, I wouldn't tell them about my work because we've always been highly competitive. I certainly wouldn't tell them about my feelings of any uncertainties with life or various things I do. And I wouldn't talk about my marriage and sex life. But after that, I would tell them anything." After a brief pause, he laughed and said, "That doesn't leave a hell of a lot, does it?" Male friendships tend to be centered not around exchanging private worlds, but about standing shoulder to shoulder in action. While men's friendships may be lacking in personal intimacy, they are rich in the loyalty it takes to stand side by side in a common enterprise. Soldiers will die for each other. A man may be willing to give up his life for his friends. Does that fit your experiences pretty well, or is there anything you'd like to add or share?
Just the observation that is, I think, men's task to resolve those problems and work through that. I've had the opportunity to do so. It's extremely enriched my life.
I think there's more talk about it now, though. That's kind of a fact. Why people are maybe trying to work on it. I have a male friend that I like a lot, but you know, he talks about facts and things at work and stuff. And I can't get him into feelings. You know, just get expensive.
On our way here, I stopped and visited friends that we've known for a lot of years, and he has been in our men's group for a lot of years. And one of the things that, well, at least 5 years, I guess, because we visited them 4 years ago, but one of the things that I thought was almost a marker between what would happen in a women's and a men's group was he was going to be late because he was at this group. And she said, well, there are problems going on. She said, the group went into business together.
Oh.
They bought downtown property and now there's all these tensions going on. And I thought, I just can't imagine a woman's group for intimacy going into business.
They got a beer in a way, didn't they?
You know, and so now there's all these problems because one of the guys was a contractor and he wants more they're not. And I thought, you know, what proof that it's a long struggle?
Well, we're going to look at a celebrated model of friendship in the Bible, as I said, the friendship between David and Jonathan. And I want to start at the end of the story, or at least the end of the story for Jonathan, because David's life continues after this, and I assume that David continues to remember Jonathan for the rest of his life. So it's not really the end of the story of their friendship, and actually the fact that we're talking about it 3,000 years later means it wasn't the end of the story either. Now, David, as we know, as we might remember from yesterday, is a nobody, a shepherd, eighth son of Jesse, who has been, the storyteller tells us, anointed by God to be the next king of Israel. The previous king, or the current king, actually, we can't write him off yet. He's still alive, still kicking, and still active, and still thinks he's king, and still is king in everyone's eyes, except maybe God's and Samuel's, is Saul. Saul was chosen because there was a military crisis in the life of Israel. The Philistines were a group of people who were threatening their way of life and needed to be stopped. And that was what the king was supposed to do. That was like his one mandate. He could do a lot of other things as well, but the thing on which the king's success would rise and fall would be how well he dealt with the Philistines. Saul is the king who is showing himself to have very uneven success with the Philistines. Sometimes he does great, sometimes he totally bombs out. In fact, in chapter 13, we see that Saul's son, Jonathan, his oldest son, has better success beating the Philistines than Saul himself does. In chapter 13, Jonathan makes a daring raid against a Philistine camp and pulls it off. And so in that chapter, the king is shown to be less of a man than his own son. Pretty bad news. Although that one of the tensions then that we're going to watch in Jonathan's life is his conflict between his loyalty to his father, who is first of all his father, and second of all his king, and the loyalty that he develops to David, who is destined to be king, but at this point in the story, only God knows that, only we listeners know that, Samuel knows it, I think David hopes it and knows it, he's been anointed, but you know, of course he has a long road to hoe before it actually will come into reality, and David kind of lives in hope and anticipation of that day, but you don't count your chickens before they're hatched, in a way. Maybe David is counting on those chickens hatching, but right now, a lot of it looks like eggs and is pretty fragile, and it's step by step by step. Jonathan is an interesting character in this because he has deep loyalties in both directions. He also has deep, it's not just a matter of his personal loyalties, it's also a matter of Jonathan's potential career. Because as the son of the reigning king, he is at least going to be one of the contenders for the next time the kingship is open. Now, there hasn't been a king in Israel before, so it's not clear that the kingship will be handed down from father to son to father to son to father to son. The practice in Israel to this date has been that the leaders have been people who were gifted for it, not people who were related to some other people. It's not completely true because Samuel's children were anointed or elected as prophets, served as prophets after him. So there's some ambiguity at this point in Israel's history what Jonathan would be in line for. From Saul's point of view, he wants Jonathan to be the next king. From Jonathan's point of view, he doesn't want the job. And we'll see some of those things here. All right, let's go to the end of their friendship in the sense that it was the end of Jonathan's life and see how David sums up what this relationship has meant to him. This is in 2 Samuel chapter 1. Yeah, it will help if we all have the RSV because we'll be doing some reading aloud together. 2 Samuel chapter 1. Yesterday we had a heroic story about David and Goliath. It's a story that is so well beloved that it's been told so many times over the years that it's easy to retell and it's easy to see who's on the good side and who's on the bad side and stuff like that. The material that we're in today, we're more in what seems to me like real life. It's harder to tell what the choices will be. People struggle a little more to decide what should be done. Somehow God's will gets done, even amidst all the ambiguous choices and conflicting loyalties that happen in daily life. So the end of the story is that David finally had to flee from King Saul. King Saul, who's supposed to be fighting the Philistines, ended up constantly trying to fight David. David, who for a while was a right-hand man of Saul and was someone who was winning battles for him, for the Israelite cause, and Saul took that very personally, for me, Saul, you know, you're winning battles, was someone who was so successful, as Saul was not, that Saul felt jealous, and the scripture actually says that God would from time to time send an evil spirit to Saul and he would lose his temper and just become angry and try to kill David. We'll look at one of those times in a little bit later in the hour. And finally, David wasn't going to hang around for that anymore, and he left. And ironically, I mean, this is one of those painful ironies, what did David do when he was trying to keep away from Saul? Well, the safest place to keep away from Saul was with the Philistines. So David worked as a hired man in the Philistine camp for a long time. And even there, Saul tried to track him down and kill him. It was like Saul turned what was supposed to be directed against the enemy, the Philistines, and directed it against someone he perceived as an enemy, David. And so David, although he was working for the Philistines at this time, was not involved in this big battle on Mount Gilboa, during which King Saul and his three oldest sons and his armor bearer and many of the men of Israel were killed. David, the Philistine captain, had looked at David at that point and said, you know, I don't know if you're really a good person to have along in a fight against the Israelites, because who's going to say that you wouldn't turn coat and work against us instead of for us, even though we're giving you a paycheck right now. So he sent David off on another task instead, and so David was far away from the battle at which Saul lost his life. But David heard about the death of Saul at the beginning of this first chapter of 2 Samuel, and here's how he heard about it. On the third day after this battle, a man came from Saul's camp, I'm reading in verse 2, with his clothes rent and earth upon his head. I mean, he's just a mess. He's obviously been through a hard time. When he came to David, he fell to the ground and did obeisance, which he would do before a king. So David says to him, "Where'd you come from?" The guy says, "Well, I came from the battle of the camp of Israel." David said, "How'd it go? Tell me." And he answered, "People have fled the battle, many of the people have fallen and are dead, and Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." So David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and Jonathan are dead?" Well, this guy goes a little further, and he says, "Well, I was there. In fact, I'm the person who put the sword through Saul." Now, in the previous chapter, at the end of 2 Samuel, it says Saul committed suicide because he saw how the battle was going. This man tells a version that's a little bit different. It says he was already wounded. He wasn't going to make it. I put him out of his misery at his request, kind of thing. We don't have any evidence to know which is the truer story. But this is the story that David hears. Notice it's a story where the guy says, "I put him out of his misery. He wasn't going to make it anyhow." David's reaction now, you notice this guy when he arrived, he did obeisance to David as you would to a mighty lord. This messenger is thinking he's bringing really good news to David. After all these years of being plagued by Saul, and all these years of being one who's obviously better fit to lead Israel, David could at this point go, "Hallelujah, you know, this is my chance. I'm going to go in and claim the kingship now. I'm one of the best candidates available." I suppose in David's opinion, he would say flatly, "I'm the best candidate available. You know, what's going to keep me from getting it?" And I think that's what the messenger is expecting. And he's probably expecting some kind of great reward. You know, "Thanks for telling me this is the opportunity for me to seize power. You know, I'm not going to let there be a power vacuum among the Israelites. I'll go right in." But in verse 11, we see David's depth both of personhood and also his public astuteness. I mean, one thing that worked so well for David was that his own reactions to things were also good for the community. And instead of going, "Hallelujah, here's my chance to be king," David says, "The king, my king, the king of my people is dead." And he goes into mourning. He weeps, he wails, he cries, he laments. And then, next thing he does is he gets around to killing this messenger who brought him the news. Because he says, "You put the sword through the anointed king of Israel. You had no right to do that." So through the whole thing, David has maintained a lot of respect for the office of king. After all, it's the office he aspires to, as well as personal attention to the person who was the king. He'd been the musician for Saul to soothe him in the beginning, and then a couple times later on, even when he and Saul were clearly enemies because of Saul's initiative, not because of David's, because of Saul's initiative, there were a couple times that David could have killed Saul, and he chose not to, although one time he taunted him by cutting off a piece of his robe. He was so close that he could have run him through. And then he said, "See, I was this close. Your men are not protecting you the way they should be." But David himself is honorable in this way. I mean, also it's clear, you know, there's no question that he is not implicated in the death of Saul. David's hands are clean of blood guiltiness by the time he reaches the throne. And that's real important to say. He didn't set out to do it. Yahweh, God, did it for him. But anyhow, with all that going on, let's look at David's song of grief.
Can I ask a question, yeah. John? Why did this messenger, what put him in a position to proclaim David then the next king? And why did David kill him? I mean, out of a fit of rage or to make it look good like I had nothing to do with Saul's death?
Was it just show, or did he mean something by it? I mean, was it just a public relations ploy? I think he was deeply offended that the one who held the office of king in Israel had been killed. You were not supposed to kill the Lord's anointed. You were supposed to help, honor, aid, abet, assist that person.
But if that person had been commanded by the king, you know, put me out of my misery, and he was the one who brought, you know, the trappings of the kingship, you know, the crown, the armband, or whatever.
To David. He was in effect saying, here's your chance, you're the next one. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, and I think that you're putting your finger on why Israel was so fascinated with David. He was a surprise. He wasn't just a public relations, a product of a public relations firm or something like that. He was sort of like what we had a forum about, or a class last week about Ross Perot and the media, and in the conversation it emerged that one thing people really like about Ross Perot is that he seems to be real. He doesn't seem to be owned by the media. David has that same kind of realness about him. He acts out of who he is. And sometimes it surprises people, and yet it seems to be right when you think about it or you see the reason for it. I don't know, you might not be thinking that this is right, but...
But I'm not an Israelite, you know, at the time of David, so my whole perception is commanded.
Yeah. David is saying, you don't get away in society with overturning the structures that have been set up. Mm-hmm. He could have killed Saul himself if he'd wanted Saul killed, and he'd chosen not to do it. So he didn't think it was right for anyone to choose to do it. It was really God's choice when Saul would finally have his life extinguished. Just as it had been God's choice sometime before that Saul was a lame duck king for the rest of his kingship because he hadn't done what he needed to do and was misusing his power. Any more about that?
Well, I think from the PR point of view, one could say, well, if he let him live, people might suspect that this was David's man who did it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, more politic for David to kill him.
Interesting. You know, there's a similar passage later, too, I think around chapter 3 or 4, where there is another son of Saul still alive. And there are a lot of people, apparently, who supported Saul who are not at all sure that David, this renegade, this outlaw, should be the next king. And they're going to look for a candidate from the people who stayed loyal to Israel, didn't go off and serve the Philistines, after all. And so it's supposed by some of David's followers that one of the likely candidates would be this son of Saul's, whose name is Ishbosheth, who did not die in the battle at Mount Gilboa. And so these followers of David kill Saul's son, Ishbosheth, and come back to David and say, we killed one of the people who's going to be one of your competitors for the throne, you know, isn't that good news? And David kills both of them. Because he says, no, I'm not in the business of killing my competitors.
Just my messengers.
Just my messengers. That's right. And we might come back to that story in a minute. Anyhow, it's sort of that same policy. He has a high respect for the office. Okay, well, we want to look. Let's read together verses 19 to 27, which is David's lament upon the death of Saul and Jonathan. He said, thy glory, O Israel, is slain upon thy high places. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, that's a Philistine city. Publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, nor upsurging of the deep. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and in death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you daintily in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? Jonathan lies slain upon high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. How are the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished? In spite of the years of enmity between Saul and David, David is able to say that it was the glory of Israel that was slain on the high places. And he uses that line, how are the mighty fallen, as a refrain or an antiphon that reappears through this lament. The main body of the lament itself has kind of, it seems to me, has kind of a mirror shape. The center part of it is that both of them were valiant in war, and that in the big picture of things, they really had done what they were called to do. The bow of Jonathan did not turn back. The sword of Saul returned not empty. They did what Saul had been called to do. And Jonathan, as the son and as the commander-in-chief of Saul's army for much of his life, had done that. Then he gives kind of a blessing, a summary about Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely. A curse of the mountain on which they died just before that centerpiece. And then the daughters of Israel should weep for the great loss, just as, don't let the Philistines hear about this because they won't understand what this means to the life of Israel. This is a loss, and the Philistines will, of course, not think of it as a loss. So that's kind of the arcing shape of the lament itself. And then there's this special poem tacked on at the end, tied into it by using the same refrain, how are the mighty fallen? And it's a poem about Jonathan in particular and the friendship of Jonathan and David. And what an intimate and deep thing to say. I'm distressed. How pleasant you've been to me. Your love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. Now we're going to look back and see some of the things that happened between Jonathan and David, so we'll know that why this was David's summary of the relationship. The first time that they meet, we've got to go to the bottom here, I kind of worked backwards. The first time they met was 1 Samuel 18. This picks up right after where we left off yesterday. This unknown shepherd boy has just shown up and indicted the faith both of Israel and of the Philistines and shown that there is a living God in Israel who does deliver the lambs, the weak people, the threatened people from the strong and mighty people. David has been able to break an impasse that Saul and Saul's armies were not able to break for 40 days and 40 nights, this particular confrontation with the Philistines. And Saul is wondering, who is this kid? And sends him out, has him called in. And David, at the end of chapter 17, says, well, I'm the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. He doesn't say, I'm David. The suggestion is that this is survival literature and David's got to be a little cagey. He can't reveal everything there is about him because at some level he knows this relationship with Saul is going to be problematic. But as he speaks in Saul's tent, when he'd finished speaking to Saul, the beginning of chapter 18, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Why?
Was he impressed because he brought the head of Goliath?
Maybe, but if it was because he brought the head of Goliath, then why didn't Saul love him that way? Or Abner, the army guy who's there?
There wasn't a competition.
There's not the competition between David and Jonathan?
I think you can explain why you're knit to certain people.
Yeah.
It just works for certain people.
Was Jonathan kind of the heir to the throne? Is that how they're
He'd at least be in the running. It wouldn't be clear that he'd be the next king, but he'd certainly be one of the top three candidates.
So you would think there'd be competition there too?
You would think there would be competition there. And you would think...
Except he didn't want the job.
Except he didn't want the job. But we don't know that yet either. But maybe he knows it. Maybe he knows it. I did ask... a good answer for it. I think it's something about the mystery of love.
Right. I think it's in the more in the form of falling in love. And he was an attractive young man, partly. He was a brave young man.
Yeah.
It seems as though that's what it's saying, is that it was one of those inexplicable events.
Yeah, and deep, and Jonathan decided to act on it.
And I think because it was between two men, we tend to try to see it in a different way, but that in fact that's what was happening.
It certainly was something that changed the course of Jonathan's life, and it looks like it probably helped change the course of David's life too, because Saul might have actually axed him, except for the intervention of Jonathan at a couple of points, key points. So Saul took David that day and wouldn't even let him go back home, and then Jonathan, verse 3, made a covenant with David, because he loved him as his own soul. This is Jonathan, really. The New Testament version of this is love your neighbor as yourself. And Jonathan is really doing this with David. Mm-hmm. And it's unusual to say that people make covenants with each other. I mean, a covenant is often a word reserved in the scriptures for the relationship between God and God's people. And it was known in Bible times to happen between rich and powerful rulers and the people that they conquered, so that, you know, we're going to have this covenant, and that means I'm going to continue to do what I, the rich and powerful ruler, have always done, which is throw my weight around and send my armies in, which will protect you so long as you cooperate with me and send me taxes and grain and let me use your men as my mercenaries, and so on and so on. That kind of thing was known as a covenant. Marriage was a covenant. There were certain things, but here in this mysterious thing that's not family and not legislated by state laws and customs, in this area of freedom, of personal choice, Jonathan develops a covenant of loyalty with David.
How about how old are they?
No.
Young.
Would it make a difference?
Well, it's not uncommon for young boys to just kind of like each other and start hanging out. I remember being blood brothers.
Right, yeah.
You know, that's not uncommon.
Yeah.
Well,
you've
done it this
one,
haven't
you? Yeah. You've done this fantastic thing.
Yeah.
And they were both old enough to be warriors.
Yeah.
That probably that was teenagers.
Yeah, teenagers.
Yes. Yeah. Because David was living at home just before he came.
One of the interesting things about this is the ongoing implications this has both for David and David's career, David personally and professionally, and for Jonathan personally and professionally, and for Jonathan's descendants. It's sort of like this, if it is a boyish covenant and they're blood brothers, they like each other, Jonathan maybe notices it first but brings it to David's attention, David's in on this covenant, it's sort of like how they let that continue to shape their relationship. It's a relationship that they choose and re-choose and re-choose again and again and again, even under testing and duress.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think you can discount the hand of guidance either. You know, that you know, in the Old Testament, when they were talking too much about the movement of the Spirit. But, you know, I think the Spirit works in our life. Mm-hmm.
Through their friendship.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone in the first hour pointed out that Jonathan's name means the gift of God. And without turning Jonathan into a stick figure here and say he's only here to move the plot along, there is something about Jonathan being a gift to David. Because the covenant that he made with David was really a lot like the covenant that God made with God's people. God wasn't standing there either with sword and spear and saying to Israel, you know, you're going to keep this covenant or else. It was a covenant made out of the mystery of choice and the mystery of freedom, and a covenant that needed to be reaffirmed by both sides again and again and again, and was reaffirmed more often on God's side than on Israel's side.
And I think young people respond more openly, you know, oftentimes to being led by God, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, in verse 4, Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow, and his girdle. The first response of Jonathan to David is to love him. The next response is to make himself vulnerable to this friend that he's identified and chosen.
Did he actually give up his place as leader of the army?
Yeah. No, he didn't. He didn't give up his place as leader of the army in actuality, but symbolically. Symbolically, he gave it up right here. And that's the foreshadowing that's implicit in this. I mean, at this point, how could Jonathan know that David was going to be the next king? He doesn't. But that's the foreshadowing that's here. And we have an advantage as members of the audience instead of players in the drama, because we know things about how it's going to turn out that they don't know. And that's called irony. When we know it and they don't, and we feel more poignancy in the story because we know it and they don't. And one thing that goes through this whole relationship is this irony and how we see depths in what they say that they couldn't have known. Well, so this is good news for David and Jonathan, but it gets to be bad news. Poses some problems, because David goes out and was successful wherever Saul sent him. You'd think that Saul would take this as good news too, but it didn't work. This was good in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants, set up for trouble, because Saul is someone who wants to be popular and wants to be liked, and David. And just look down a few verses. The women sang to one another as they made merry, "Saul has slain his thousands, David his 10,000s." And oh, that must have irked Saul and galled him. And I want to just... especially with the women singing it, right? I mean, David has this kind of animal magnetism. He's popular to the men and the women and the servants of Saul. He's even popular to Saul. I mean, Saul depends on him for the music that he plays, depends on him for the leadership that he provides against the Philistines. So David is just this, Saul has this vexed relationship with David. He can't live with him and he can't live without him. And then we've got Jonathan. Not only Jonathan, but other of Saul's children as well. Two of his daughters, especially one of his daughters, gets involved with David. Verse 20 of the same chapter. Saul's daughter, Michal, loved David. But that's a little later, and we're not going to deal with that. We're just going to follow the thread of Jonathan loving David and see what happens there.
One thing that's interesting is just to think about the need for leaders, powerful people, to have friends. Because I think so often when we've had leaders that have problems, it's the leaders that don't have anyone that tells them the truth. Or, you know, someone who's above their power position loves them just because of who they are. So
yeah, to use them, to manipulate them instead of...
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually... Jonathan's friendship with David is not like Nathan the prophet, who holds a mirror of truth up to David, which we're looking at in a day or two. But Jonathan's friendship with David is this totally gracious one. It's constantly support and love and giving, protection, advocacy. There's not much truth that Jonathan holds up to David except the truth of, I love you, you are lovable.
Except if he had survived.
If Jonathan had survived.
What would he have become if he had that total acceptance? Would he have been able to become a Nathan to say, you aren't being the person that you're true, that if you were being true to yourself, you would? Because I think that's what real friends do.
Yeah. So in a way, maybe Verlon has put us on something. This is a friend of your youth, you know, one of those friends who's just total gift in your life. And it's interesting to think about what would have happened if Jonathan had lived. But let's move on to a time that Jonathan advocates for David with his father, 1 Samuel 19. Well, this Saul, the king, is mercurial. Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. Jonathan told David, "Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Therefore, take heed to yourself in the morning. Stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And I'll go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I'll speak to my father about you. And if I learn anything, I'll tell you." And Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his deeds have been of good service to you. For he took his life in his hand, and he slew the Philistine. And the Lord wrought a great victory for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause?" And Saul hearkened to the voice of Jonathan. Saul swore, and this is a solemn oath, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death." And Jonathan called David, and Jonathan showed him all these things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as before. Sounds pretty good. It takes only about 3 verses to change the situation. There was a war again. David went out and fought with the Philistines, made a great slaughter among them so that they fled before him. Then an evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing the lyre. And Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he eluded Saul so that he struck the spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped. Saul is someone who makes solemn promises, unlike his son Jonathan, makes solemn promises and then changes them, and then changes them. And that's one reason he's not a good king, because you don't know where he stands and what the straight path is going to be. It's kind of, you know, what's happening now and what seems to be the move I should make. It's not even as rational as what seems to be the next move that I should make. But here we have Jonathan beginning to play a mediating role between the two of them and beginning to see the conflict that his covenant of love with David might lead him into when he has another kind of obligatory relationship with his father. His father is his father. He has the commandment that he shall honor his father and mother, that he may live long upon the earth. He also has the commandment that he shall honor his king. And is this covenant of love he made with David going to lead him into conflict with his father? How is he going to, what's the question of loyalty for Jonathan? That's the question that he's going to try to deal with. And he's going to try to deal with it honorably in both directions. What is it that loyalty means?
Could it be that Jonathan is symbolic of the people of Israel who recognizes in David a born leader of spiritual strength? And you even see this in grade school classes. You see certain kids emerge that others just follow because they are born leaders. And maybe Jonathan is not just, it's not just a youth covenant, but a covenant of the people with David.
Yeah. And so the question for us at that point would be, if we were going to make this an analogy, if we were going to let this story work in our own experience, like yeast in the lump or something, we'd say we have structures that we have set up for the good of society. We have people filling certain offices the way Saul was filling the office of king. What's our loyalty to support and maintain the structures that we've set in place in all good faith, trying to work for the good of society, when we feel that truth, leadership, response to what really, effective response to what really needs to be done might be happening outside of these spheres?
Well, when our spirit says.
Yes.
Because the covenant is between the souls of these men. So
that's right.
It's beyond the structures.
That's right. And so if our government is not doing anything about the environment, and the environment arises as a cause which our soul is called to, and there are people involved with that who may be outside of or even against or disapproved of by the government, the powers that be, where does our loyalty go? If our congregation has a pastor whose ministry we feel is ineffective, and then there gets to be a way in the congregation or someone in the congregation who's proposing an alternative or who we see as someone who could do it better, or we know of another pastor we'd like to call or whatever, what's the question of loyalty for us as we're between these two choices? Now, you have answers?
That's a very real one.
Yeah.
Because you see real poison things happen when people will get rid of someone. And it's the church you have, and you end up with both segments feeling in the right side. Church so to somehow honor both is important.
And that's the line that Jonathan walks, to honor both. And in his honoring both, he actually gives a great gift to David, because he's one of the first people to, well, we'll come to that. I won't anticipate it. We'll let the text unfold that to us as we go along. Well, right now, at this point, Jonathan thinks he's solved, we don't have enough time to do it either. Jonathan thinks he's solved the problem between his father and David. And he thinks that this is going to hold, although it should be clear to him that it doesn't work, because it just takes a few more verses before Saul tries to pin him to the wall. But David still thinks Jonathan still thinks he has some leverage with his father. What happens in chapter 20 is that Jonathan discovers he doesn't have leverage with his father. His father is beyond the scope of reason. And that they're really, you have to work around him, you can't work with him. Jonathan discovers this by, David is saying, Jonathan, I'm afraid to go in there, I'm afraid your father's going to kill me. Jonathan says, no, we can reason with my father, he can hear reason. David says, I don't think so. Make this test, I'm going to not be at a feast where I'm supposed to be, and you check out your father's reaction. If your father's murderously angry, you'll know that there's no dealing with him, no reasoning with him. And so Jonathan says, okay, I'll do that. Well, it happens, and Saul is murderously angry. And he's not murderously angry at David, actually. He turns his murderous anger on Jonathan and does this throw the spear to try to pin the guy against the wall kind of thing again against his own son. And it's worth looking at what David charges his son with. Chapter 20, verse 30. In 1 Samuel. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said to him, who's just made an excuse why David isn't there. And Saul said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman.
Uh-oh, that was a real swear word.
It is, and he's disowned him. I mean, he's even not admitted his connection with his own son at that point. Do I not know that you have chosen this son of Jesse, whose name he will not even permit himself to utter, to your own shame, to the shame of your mother's nakedness? We did a little bit of looking at the passages in Leviticus that this might be referring to, and this is the extremes of shamefulness, and it also seems that what's in here is Saul is somehow accusing his son of sexual betrayal. Yeah.
What?
He's accusing his son of sexual betrayal. Now it's unclear and confusing because the passage in, let's not get into it, we really don't have time. I probably have to tell you now since we've gotten this far. The passage in Leviticus that we found that's the closest parallel, the person who is shamed by an illicit sexual relationship would be the person of the same, we'll see, how does this go? This gets very confusing because it's not an exact parallel, but the thing is, your uncle would be shamed if you slept with your uncle's wife. So why here is it the mother who is shamed, unless there's an implication? That there were somehow, the relationship between David and Jonathan was illicit in terms of the law of Israel. And the implication would be that Saul is assuming what in his own time would be the worst. He's assuming.
Assuming or accusing.
Accusing, yeah. He's jumping to the worst conclusion. Not. This is not, you know, this is more than a friendship. This is a homosexual relationship, which in our society, Saul is saying is taboo. Except he's not saying it out loud. He's just assuming the worst and acting like that's the case. So he's kind of pulling, I mean, whether he believes this to be the case or not, whether we would react the same way or not, Saul is kind of going to the worst conclusion in terms of his own society and his own values that he can make, and accusing his own son of this. And it's odd he's doing it in the name of the honor of his son. You've chosen this son of Jesse, because as long as the son of Jesse lives upon the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Saul's saying, I'm doing this for your own good. I want you to be king, and I want your sons to be king after you. And don't you know this son of Jesse is the major obstacle and threat? Therefore, send and fetch him to me, for he shall surely die. But Jonathan continues to maintain David's innocence, and then he grieves for him, and then he goes out and actually has worked out this secret way. He's going to tell David whether it's safe to stay or whether he has to go. But it turns out the secret communication method involving sending a little boy out to collect some arrows that David, or that Saul, that Jonathan shoots, is unnecessary because they have a time to get together personally. And so in verse 41, as soon as the lad had gone, David rose from beside the stone heap where he was hiding to hear the secret message from Jonathan. David fell on his face on the ground and bowed three times. They kissed one another and wept with one another until David recovered himself. This maybe is the first time we see how much David is involved in this relationship, not just Jonathan. I mean, David's been going along with it, but here we have an indication that it comes from the depths of David, as well as it's not just mercenary. David's not just doing this because it looks like good for his future, but he's in it personally. Then Jonathan said to David, go in peace, for as much as we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord shall be between me and you, between my descendants and your descendants, forever. And David rose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. So they go back to their own locations again. They're separate, but this covenant continues to be operative between them, even though they can't choose to be together. And I think we have time to look at their last meeting in 1 Samuel 23:15 to 18. Let's do that for sake of completeness. 1 Samuel 23. Well, it's the same old story again. David was afraid because Saul had come to seek his life. Verse 15, David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. And Jonathan, Saul's son, rose and went to David at Horesh and strengthened David's hand in God. This fine line of loyalty that Jonathan walks. I mean, he's still with his father. He's his father's commander-in-chief. He's working on behalf of the Israelites. He has not broken his relationship with his father, but he also does not break his relationship with David. And Jonathan said to David, fear not. You know, it's what the angel always says in the New Testament, don't be afraid. Here's Jonathan saying it to David. So Jonathan is really the agent of God's love for David. Fear not, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel. It's been implicit all along, but now Jonathan is saying it. And I shall be next to you. In other words, I'm not going to be the king.
But I mean, he also said, because you were asking what would have happened had he lived.
Yeah, and so Jonathan is saying, I'll give you my loyalty. And then he says, Saul, my father, also knows this. Now, I don't think Saul knew that he knew it, except maybe in the pit of his stomach or the back of his mind. And Saul was certainly not acting on that principle. But Jonathan says that Saul knows it. And the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. David remained at Horesh and Jonathan went home. They split up in the same two directions again. But it's kind of as if you can never tell your friends enough how much your love means and that you're still in that bond of friendship. David and Jonathan renew it whenever they're together. And it's, again, this is what you were pointing out. It's not just professional, it's also personal. It's not just God operating out in the stratosphere someplace, but it's God making these promises real and giving grace through the hard decisions and the personal choices of loyalty that we make. Jonathan never breaks his loyalty to his father. He disagrees with his father, especially when he feels it's an evil spirit out of which his father is acting towards David. But loyalty to his father means, I'm going to stick with you, Dad, in spite of that. But loyalty, the gifted loyalty to David, the one that comes out of freedom and grace and somehow detecting what God's will for the future might be and living that future already today, Jonathan doesn't break his loyalty with David either. And so we can go one of two directions. We can talk about how our loyalties and choices help God's kingdom come, and how do we know we're working with God's kingdom? Oh, yeah, small talk for the next 5 minutes, or if we have even that long. I think what I'll do instead, since that kind of conversation we carry on in our minds, hearts, and talks with each other from now to the day we die, let me just summarize for you an interesting way of looking at this relationship from Philip Culbertson, book published in 92 by Fortress Press, New Adam, The Future of Male Spirituality. He says that the relationship between David and Jonathan is a text of terror for men. Text of terror is a phrase that came from Phyllis Trible, the Old Testament scholar, who looked at a number of times in the Old Testament that women's lives were ruined because of assumptions that their society made, and there was no way to get out of them. And so Philip Culbertson says, well, this is a text of terror for men, because in ancient Israel, the same thing was true as is true now. They reflect to us our own situation. Namely, it's a story about a young man whose father's trying to get him to go into the family business, even though the son doesn't want to. Namely, Jonathan. And what do you know about families where the father puts so much pressure on the son until the son finally either cracks or rebels or escapes, and what the damage in those families into the son's lives are for years and years if it ever gets repaired? Second of all, this is a story about a son who feels an intense amount of loyalty to an emotionally ill father. What do you know about the stories of your own experiences of trying to care for someone who ought to be caring for you, and at what expense to the caregiver does it come to try to take care of someone who's unpredictable, unstable, and hard to deal with? Number three, this is a story about how suspicious society is of close male friendship. Society comes through in Saul's charge against Jonathan when he just loses it and is angry with Jonathan about the commitment between David and Jonathan. And that is not different today. And number four, this story makes friendship look dangerous. Because the men get hurt emotionally. They have to make hard choices. They lose each other. They grieve. You know, they're sitting there crying until David finally recovers himself enough to say goodbye in that passage in 1 Samuel 20. And contemporary men are so unsure of emotions that they avoid them when possible, Culbertson says, especially emotions that hurt. And if friendship opens you up to vulnerability and hurt and pain this way, why would you want to do it? Except that somehow the life of God is operative in those friendships. Somehow that's where we receive and give God's love, where we live the kingdom that we want to live in. So that, is it worth it? Is it not worth it? So are there any comments you want to make before we go up to coffee break?
Well, you've made it come alive.
Okay, we'll be talking tomorrow about something. I think I'm changing what I thought I was going to do tomorrow. I think we'll talk about the covenant that God made with David to establish his leadership through the years. So if you can come back and want to, I hope you will. Thanks.